I am replacing Tom G., who wasn't able to be here this morning, so it's my privilege to chair this meeting. Can we have a moment of silence, please? Thank you. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our first speaker, Scott G. from New York.
Hi, I'm Scott. I'm an alcoholic. All right, I got that part out. I tell you, these ladies are so happy I'm going first. I already feel like I'm doing service, you know. They're going to put me at ease. I'm from the East Village in New York. My home group's Living Now down there. There's a few of us here. and I think first and foremost, you know, I believe that I'm a representative of Living Now here. Because AA, you know, really saved my life, but Living Now specifically saved my life. I shuffled in there like 2 years ago, almost 30 pounds lighter than I am now. Just totally beaten. You know, I was detoxing off of methadone, heroin, Oxycontin, ecstasy, Klonopin, Xanax, and alcohol. Don't worry, people. I see the furrowed brows happening. But... And I'm sad to say my last drink was Bailey's Irish Cream. So... It was like a family-sized bottle of Bailey's Irish Cream. That's all I could drink. I needed something sweet. Coming off of that methadone, man. And, I shuffled into Living Now. I still have my hospital bracelet on. You know, I got my rubber slippers on, and I'm just like... And I sat down in there and raised my hand. I said, I'm Scott. I'm an alcoholic. I just got out of detox a half hour ago. And that was... my first spiritual experience, you know. There's a guy here, in fact, I don't know where Augie's sitting, but there he is. You know, he was the first person that reached out, and he patted me on the back, and I just started crying, you know. And, and here we are, a little over 2 years later, and I'm standing up here speaking, you know, it's ridiculous. It's, there's something going on, you know, in the higher power department, that's for sure. And, but I was just so relieved, and it was so overwhelming to have someone, like, reach out and just pat me on the back, you know. I've been, like, completely cut off from my family for years, friends, you know, I burned through everyone, you know, coming to that last bottom, and just having people look, you know, reach out, pat me, look at me, start crying. I'm crying at them, they're crying at me, you know, and I didn't even really know what was happening, but it was, you know, as I look back on it, I realized what a relief it was that people knew how I was feeling, you know. And I always walked around feeling like nobody understood my particular melancholy, you know, and, thinking that that was unique, you know, and certainly all my friends all my life, I was always the one that was worse off in the alcohol and drug department. And, just going in there, especially at Living Now, you get the real feeling that other people have been down as low as you are, you know, it's an eclectic group. And, that was the tail end of 24 years of drinking and drugging, and so there was a lot of wreckage, you know. And I had been to, you know, been to hospitals for a suicide attempt, was in a lockdown mental ward, there were two broken marriages, you know, one that was breaking as I was sitting in that room for the first day, little did I know, because I ended up getting sober and my wife didn't, you know, she's actually still out there. And wow, what is happening? What my greatest fear is happening right now? Blank. Anyway, I'll tell you, one drunk story, just to show that I qualify. You know, I was ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to be an international rock star. And this, you know, after 15 years of slugging it out in New York City, you know, playing clubs and everything, my band released a little, like, on an independent label, very small label. But, you know, my record made it into Tower Records, and that was enough, you know, for me to really start believing the hype. And I was in full-time rock and roll mode all the time. I mean, at this point, I had black hair that was, like, down to here. It was with a purple stripe. I had, like, raccoon eye makeup, you know, to go to the deli. I was all the time. It was on. And I moved out to Hollywood for a year with my wife, who became the bass player of the band. And we went out there to get the big record deal. So we hooked up with big record lawyers and managers and a big name producer, and everything was looking good. You know, except my alcoholism. And as it turned out, I was, you know, they deemed me too difficult to work with, and everything. We did a showcase for every major record label in Los Angeles, and I still don't know what happened. I'm still trying to piece it together, but I know I was deemed too difficult to work with, and the morning drinking after that got pretty intense. And one night I had a whole big bottle of rum that I mixed with Tang, I think, on that night. And I had three Xanax, or the blue football Xanaxes, and blacked out. And what I remember is my wife was kind of getting in my face, and I just kind of remember going like that. And what really happened is I picked her up and threw her across the room. And then I kind of, my memory kind of comes back. And she had been in an abusive relationship before, and so she was threatening to call the police on me. And this is perfect. Shows what kind of alcohol, how I was when I was drinking. She was threatening to call the police. I said, "You want to call the police? You want to call the police? I'll call the police. If you want to call the..." So I call the police on myself. The police come. They weren't even going to do anything. They were not even going to do anything. I said, "You're not going to arrest me? You get the hell out of my house. You're not going to arrest me." So they put me in the squad car. Even then, I don't believe that they were going to take me away. They went back to talk to my wife. I don't believe that they were going to take me away. But as soon as I'm in the squad car, they lock me in the back by myself. I cover the entire back with spit, with loogies. I spit all over that, all over the windows, all over the streets. I kept spitting till I had no spit left in my mouth. They came back, they're like, "What? What is the matter with you?" You know, so now we're taking them downtown. So they take, and I'm in like a wild frenzy, and I've got this hair, and I got, and I'm crying, and it's like Tammy Faye Baker, you know, I like crossed with like Marilyn Manson, And they're dragging me through the station, and I start picking on the individual police officers themselves. And I'm saying, "Do you guys have a fitness program in here, or what? What if you had to chase me? Look, you know, calling them fat, calling them pigs. What, you know, do they have any standards at all? You know, And so, but it finally came time to take my mugshot. They had to hold me on either side. So my mugshot is, I'm like, you know. And they put me in an isolation cell. And this poor little old guy, it brings me the bologna sandwich, you know, and sets it on a little tray there. And so he walks away, and I pick up the bologna sandwich and whip it after him down the hall. And he just calmly comes and sweeps it all back up. Then I take a piss out of the jail cell onto the, and the poor old guy's got to come and wipe it up again. So that's what I'm like when I'm drinking. And I had court-ordered AA, court-ordered anger management after that. And I went to meetings for 45 days in L.A. Then I moved back to New York. And but I still wasn't done, you know. I drank for 3 more years after that. And that wasn't enough, you know, that experience. And at that late stage of my drinking career, I became a heroin addict, you know, after that. And that's how I bottomed out. And part of that bottoming out, you know, with in the made direct amends subject, you know, was my relationship with my parents, you know. And as I was bottoming out, I talked with them less and less. And I had one night where I wouldn't even know how many drugs I had or what was in my system. I can't even remember, but I had a furious, like, disowning of my parents on the phone. I mean, it was like I hit them with every ounce of venom I could. I said, how could you? Because my big resentment with my parents is always that I feel like since I was this high, it was obvious that I was like a performer. I wanted to sing. I wanted to dance. Like, you know, every day was Halloween. I was just like one of those kids, you know. And they supported me as a kid. It was all very entertaining, you know, when I was a kid. But as I kept getting older, and I was like, I want to keep doing this, you know, this is what I want to do for a living. Then it was when my parents were like, you know, product of the Great Depression and stuff. My parents are older, and they wanted me to get a suitable education, the liberal arts and business or something like that. And I can always do this as a hobby, you know. And I just never understood that. I always believed in myself as a performer, and I resented that so much, and I drank behind that so much, you know, and used behind that. And as soon as that was the case, I was going away to college, and I couldn't go to, like, the art school I wanted, and this kind of stuff. My parents and I just, you know, like that. And so I was really laying into them. I was like, how could you? How could you know who I was? You know, you knew I was always a performer, you know, yeah. How could you do this to me? Who do you think you are? You know, and, you know, F you. I never want to talk to you again. You know, it was just like the bile, the very like bile, the anger. And that was the last time I talked to them, you know, until I ended up in the hospital. So, you know, there was an amends to make there. And, you know, as, you know, first is that I was very, let me just say, when I was getting sober, I was very eager, you know, to start working the steps. And every sponsor I had, actually, I fired this poor guy that pat me on the back that first day. And my sponsor, because he wouldn't let me go through the steps at the, you know, blinding speed I wanted to. And I just wanted to get it done, you know. So, you know, then I ended up with a sponsor. So it was very much like, whoa, 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 you know. But, you know, I did the classic thing, like making my 8-step list was take the names over from my 4-step list. So there was all this stuff with my parents and the resentment for not supporting my, you know, genius as an artist and everything. And, two, you know, as when it came to time to make amends, you know, I sat down with my sponsor and went over each amends that I was going to make. You know, I put like a name on each a page of like a three-ring notebook binder and left enough room, you know, because in many instances, you know, I needed a script to operate from because, you know, it was some dicey situations, you know. You know, and I read the ninth step this morning just to kind of prep for this, and the first two words are good judgment, you know. And that's, you know, that is not a hallmark of my active life, certainly. And so I need to go over everything with my sponsor, you know. And we went over the amends to my parents, like, very carefully. And the first thing I was to do was to thank them for all the support they give me through the years. So, like, ooh. Already, you know. That was a lot, you know, because I was so resentful, you know. And so when it came down to talking to them, I took the bus down to Pennsylvania where they live, and I sat at the kitchen table with my mom. My mom's here, my dad's here, and I say, you know, part of this program is, you know, make amends, and you know, I need to make an amends with you guys. And the first thing I want to do is thank you guys for your support, you know. And my dad just went dead silent, you know. And I was like, I know it's hard, because it really hit me that they watched me bottom out for all these years, you know. And there was never kind of any intervention or anything in my family. They really, like, intuitively knew this kind of thing where they had to let me bottom out, you know. And so I thanked them. There were so many like specific things really that I need to apologize for, that really I just like apologized for everything that I had done and everything that they had to like put up with through the years, you know. And the main thrust of it was that I love you, you know, and thank you for your support. And my dad, and the thing about these amends is like none of them went like I thought, you know, they're gonna go. And this, I expected a big love in, there'd be tears and I love yous and everything. My dad was completely silent. He was staring in that direction. When I was halfway through speaking, he started tearing up, stood up, and walked away. So it was just my mom there. And I finished, and my mom just stared straight ahead, not at me, and she said, you know, we really should have put you in counseling when you were in high school. And that was it. That was it. You know, and then came like the living amends part, you know, that really had, and that's what's really had resonance for me, you know, is like a living amends to my parents. And one of them is that walking to this, you know, Sunday morning meeting at Living Now. If you're ever in New York, you got to come to Sunday morning Living Now at 10 a.m. It's like a massive, you know, a church of the spirit, you know, it's jumping. And when I'm walking to that meeting every Sunday, I call my parents. And that's like, that's the stuff that means so much to them. You know what I mean? Not like sitting down and saying, I'm sorry, and I'm working a program, or blah, blah, blah. They don't care about that. You know, they care about a phone call every Sunday. And if I miss that phone call for some reason, you know, they call me and they're worried. You know, now they expect me to make that phone call. And this thing happened, you know, when I got sober, I got this kind of dream job, you know, where at age 39, I'm finally making a living as a performer. You know, it's taken this long and not coincidentally getting sober. And so, and it's a great opportunity because I'm like an extra, you know, I'm not like the star of the show, you know, I work at the Metropolitan Opera and I'm like one of the spear carrier guys, you know, full time spear carrier, you know, so it's great, but there's humility there too, you know, and so my parents came, I get my parents tickets to this dress rehearsal, this big premiere, this opera with Placido Domingo and everything, and I'm sword fighting and all this stuff, and I saw they have great tickets, they come and they see me perform, and then afterwards I'm giving them a backstage tour, and they pass Placido Domingo in the hallway, and my mom's all in a tizzy, and afterwards I'm walking them to the bus station, And my mom said, you know, I really wish we would have sat you down in high school and just found it out what exactly it is you wanted to do. And I was like, you know, and that to me, that was the big amends at that moment. For me to keep my mouth shut, you know, at that moment, that's growth, man. That's higher power. You know. And I just said, it's okay. I said to her, it's okay, you know. I said, it's okay. I needed to go through, you know, what I went through. And, you know, and I couldn't have handled, you know, what I wanted to do back then, you know. And I just told her, whatever I've been through, all this stuff, it's what I needed to go through. And it's okay. And you did the best you could. I understand why you did what you did. And that was just like, you know, that's like I said, that's like this higher power thing that I question all the time, regardless of what happens to me. You know, and so many great things have happened in sobriety. And I sit around and be like, but you know, is it real? You know? You know, is there a higher power? Is this really happening? I the built-in forgetter about these clear-cut experiences where I have this experience of this power in my life, you know, I still doubt it, you know. But this amends, especially with my family, and in a situation like that, in a conversation like that, that's like concrete evidence, you know, of the change that's taken place in me that I can't always see, you know. And I guess I'll stop there. I just want to thank, you know, Doug R., who, I always wonder how the hell people get these speaking engagements, you know. And I got mine from doing service, you know, in my home group, Outgoing Speaker Commitment, Living Now, and I was speaking at the Oxford group in Manhattan, and Doug R. was there, who coordinates this whole thing, you know, so that's how it happened for me. And I'm thrilled to be here and thrilled to be alive and thrilled to be sober. And thanks.
Thank you, Scott. That was wonderful. I have one thing. I told my home group when I was going to be coming to this meeting to cheer, and they said, don't forget to mention us. I forgot. My home group in Portland, Oregon is Think About It, Big Book Study, Tuesday night. Thank you, Scott. Living amends, you know, I think about one person I was never able to make an amends to, and that was my mother. She died before I was sober. You know, but I think I'm doing today what she'd want, you know, and it's because of this fellowship. Our next speaker is Mary, Michigan.
May the words from my mouth and the meditations in my heart be acceptable to you, my Lord, my God, and my Savior. Hello, everybody. My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. I feel like the taco dog in the back of a window. Yeah. You know, in every conference that, in every meeting I've been to since Thursday, I've heard people say that people in AA trick you. I want to tell you that they do. But I also want to share with you that God has a tremendous sense of humor. A tremendous sense of humor. Because yesterday, just yesterday, I was sitting right back there, the second row up from the back. And I got to tell you, this room looked an awful lot different. Awful lot different than what it looks now. Different from up here. And I want to thank God for that. I have senior moments, so I brought a notebook. And the reason I had to laugh on the way over here because when I get emotional, I can't read. Can I tell you? So I guess I have it for a sense of security, more than anything else. Yeah, I was sitting at, you know, all the preparation, it's beautiful when they ask you to speak on a certain subject because you do a lot of preparation, of which by the time you get behind the microphone, you forget it all, every bit of it. And that's okay, too. But I was sitting at a meeting just yesterday, and it dawned on me. The light came on. I came in this program actually doing the ninth step. And not even having any previous experience. Let me tell you how that went. I'd left the bar one day, and I was riding down the road. Country road. I love to ride down country roads with whatever I had next to me. I'm quite the tourist. And I don't know where these ideas come from, but I was looking off and there was this house and I saw something shiny. It was pretty and shiny. So I pulled in the driveway. And I walked in the house. And on the screened-in porch, there was the most beautiful saddle I'd ever seen. And it was shiny. It was all polished, this saddle. Now, I drove a 1972 Cutlass Supreme at the time. And if you drank like I drank, and you drove a car, of course, you would need a saddle. Made sense to me. See, that's just it. When I drank, anything I thought, it made sense to me. So I needed that saddle. So I put it on the back seat of my car. You know, one of the, right there on the back. And I took off. And I was happy. I had a saddle. For my car. Mm-hmm. I don't know how far I got, but I remember when I was in the ditch, I was looking at the saddle. It didn't seem right. Now, to make a long story short, I got noticed by a few people with that saddle. They didn't remember me or my car, but they remembered the saddle. So I guess when the judge went to work the next day trying to figure out who broke into his house, When he put the word out, it was real. He found out real quickly what happened to his saddle. There was no problem finding me. My phone rang, and there was this man on the other end of the phone that had gotten me out of the ditch. That was a friend. At the time, I worked with him. And he kept inviting me to these meetings. He had this little white card with 12-something or others on it and a prayer on the back. And if I told him I'd go, he'd do my work that night and let me drink. So I told him I'd go. Well, that night in the ditch, who do I call? But I called Bob, right, to get me out of the ditch. So when my phone rang, it was him. And he says to me, Mary, all I have to say to you is the magistrate says you have 24 hours to bring back the saddle. I pleaded with him that you just gave birth, which I had. I had a little bouncy baby boy. So he said, I pleaded with him not to throw you in prison. And he said he wouldn't if you brought back the saddle. Now, I got to tell you, the only problem with that is there's a little thing called blackouts. Blackouts. And I lived 85 miles from where I worked and 85 miles from where the judge lived. There's a lot of road in between. And I didn't know where that saddle was. I had no idea. I probably did with it what I did with everything else in my life, disregarded it. So I had tossed that saddle, had my first experience at prayer. See, I was doing this program long before I got here. I just didn't know it. Because I did pray. And that gets me to where I am today, the amends. Because I don't ever want to forget what it was like to frantically search as many side roads as I could possibly find in 24 hours between in that 85-mile stretch. And I don't know why, but I was driving down this one road, and I saw this ravine, and a familiarity struck. And sure enough, I pulled the car off the road, and I looked down in that ravine, and there was just one little twinkle left in the mud. So I crawled down the ravine, and I got the saddle. It was a 4-H winner. That's why it was so shiny. That's why he wanted it back. It wasn't real shiny when he got it back. But I'll never forget walking up the driveway. I parked at the end of the driveway. I didn't pull up into the driveway. And I'm carrying the saddle, which, as you can see, isn't much bigger than myself. And back then I weighed 90 pounds. Sobriety has been good to me. And I carried the saddle up the driveway. And you know, I don't ever want to forget, really, the look in that man's eyes, or his daughter's. It was his daughter's saddle. She was supposed to register it again in the 4-H competition, but couldn't because it was at the bottom of the ravine. The humiliation is what I don't want to forget. And I had to stand there and try to tell those people how sorry I was and explain what I had done and why. Needless to say, I didn't have too much to say, except for I'm sorry. Because, you see, I couldn't explain to them what I myself didn't understand. Because when I wasn't drinking, what I did do when I was drinking didn't make any sense. It only made sense if I was drinking. So I had to keep drinking. And thus went my life. I'm a child prodigy, by the way. That's what I like to call myself. I started drinking at 7 years old. My parents were buying it for me by the time I was 10. And a carton of cigarettes. Always got a carton of cigarettes with my booze. The step nine for me. Yeah, I'm so grateful there's 8 steps before that step. Even though I seem to be a natural at it with the saddle. But there is 8 steps before it. And I've got to tell you, it's all about changing your relationship with God and mankind. That's what step 9 is about for me. That is when I began to change how I relate. There's a page in the big book, or in the 12 and 12, and it goes something like this. And I have to tell you, because I am going to read a little bit of it, that when I read this, it was the first time I had cried since I was 8 years old. It goes something like this. It says, but it is from our twisted relationships with family, friends, and society at large that many of us have suffered. We've suffered the most. Says we have, I love this part. I mean, no living person had guts to say to me what the big book said to me. I may be short, but I was noticeable. It says we have been especially stupid and stubborn about them. The primary fact that we fail to recognize is our total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. We have not once, it says, sought to be one in a family, a friend among friends, a worker amongst workers, to be a useful member of society. Always we struggled to try to get to the top of the heap or to hide underneath it. That was me. This self-centered behavior blocked a partnership relationship with anyone around us. Of true brotherhood, we had small comprehension. And that's how I entered Alcoholics Anonymous. That's exactly how I entered this program. By the time I was done with the 4th step and that 8th step list, my amend list was large. I had a disdain for God and for people, and I barely tolerated creatures. That's just the way it was. So I'm grateful, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I am really grateful for this step. You know, every time I think about a step, I keep thinking, God, I'm so grateful for this one. It's the cornerstone. Somehow the years have just passed by. I'm thinking every step is just the cornerstone. And it's finally dawned on me, the program. It's the whole program. You know, I marveled when Scott got up here and said he's been here for 2 years. 2 years. What a treat. What a treat. What a miracle. I entered the doors April 24th of 1976. And I'm happy to share with you that I am still learning. I'm still growing. I don't know how people get complacent in this program. I'm still running, trying to keep up. I'm still stretched, trying to understand and comprehend and do these amends, work these steps. My list, you're not going to believe this. None of you in this room will believe this, but my list has grown. Yeah, yeah. I was 24 when I got here, And being a child prodigy, there's really not a whole lot I remember between 0 and 24, except for the DTs when I was 14. And they strapped me to a bed to keep the dogs from biting me. I found out later they weren't there. So most of my mistakes I've made since I've walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Who knew? Who knew? I grew up here. So did my son. We grew up together. I used to holler at him for taking the green when we were coloring. You know, and every time that I caught on to something, it seemed like, especially where my son was concerned, I could, just when I was getting it down, you know, this parent thing, he would go through another stage. And it was catch up again. That's the way it was. So the whole program for me has been like that, and I'm still learning. Scott said, good judgment. Good judgment. And if I can get these notes straight, that I can't read only half of them anyway, only the ones I wrote big and then I forgot to rewrite them, so they're a mess. But it says good judgment, careful sense of timing, a careful sense, courage and prudence. Now those are some fine attributes. That every good alcoholic should possess. And thanks to the Al-Anons, we might have a crack at it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you can clap for Al-Anon. I love Al-Anon. I owe a great deal to Al-Anon. I think we all have them. Whether we're married to them, living with them, leading them. We all have an Al-Anon, and I have an Al-Anon in my life. Turns out for me it was my son's godmother. And I thank God to this day for that woman. And I couldn't stand up here and share any of my story without telling you that without the help of Al-Anon, I don't know, I wouldn't be here. I'd be dead. And I'm going to share something about that later. When I looked up those words, because I have to do that, I not only have senior moments, but I have empty spots. And between the senior moments and the empty spots, I have to work hard daily. You know, the bottom line is every day I have to ask God to keep me sober, to lead my path, to direct my thinking, to guide my thoughts, and to show me the way. Just show me the way. Because I am willing to follow today. I can follow today. Because of God and you people, I can follow today. You know, I was so excited to get a chance to say thank you. Not quite at this level, but it's okay. I want to say thank you. Because without you, I wouldn't have God in my life today. I had thrown him away long before I got here because I thought he threw me away. And more accurately, I really didn't throw God away. I was just too ashamed. I was too ashamed to meet him. And thanks to this program, my shame is gone. I am not ashamed today. I tell people often there's no shame in being an alcoholic. The only shame is not doing something about it. Because there is plenty of help available, and you are all living proof of that. There is plenty of help available. Is it okay yet? And I have to acknowledge my home group, which is Hemlock. I haven't told them that, but my home group is Hemlock. And they are here. They are here. So I want to thank you for that. My greatest fear was realized a long time ago, but now it's in Technicolor. Good judgment. I looked it up and it said the ability to come to an opinion about things, power of comparing, deciding, understanding, and good sense. So another 29 years in this program and I might get there. A careful sense of timing. It says the regulation of speed or the moment of the occurrence of something so has to produce the most effective result. So I guess when I cornered my ex-in-laws, 4 months into this program, I cornered them one time in an elevator and began to apologize for being their ex-daughter-in-law. And I don't think that... I think that's under this one. A careful sense of timing. I learned in this program, it also said that it took courage, and I've learned in this program that courage truly is nothing but fear that said its prayers. But Webster says that it's an attitude of facing and dealing with anything recognized as dangerous. And I don't know about you people, but I don't have a ninth step amends to make that isn't dangerous. I was just that kind of drunk. They were all dangerous. It says dangerous, painful, or difficult. And it actually says without withdrawing from it or running from it. Facing it. That's what courage is. The quality of being fearless or brave, valor. And I think that's the part where they mean courage is fear that said its prayers. I don't have those attributes. Nowhere inside this body are those attributes. But I do love, know, and serve my Lord, and He does. So I love Him. Prudence, it says, is capable of exercising sound judgment in practical matters, especially as concerns one's own interest. And then it's got those two little funny marks that says cautious and discreet. Cautious and discreet. You know, I've made many amends since I've been in this program. And I've grown from every one of them. Somewhere in the book, because if I try to read one more thing on these papers, it's just going to... It's not, my eyes are going to cross or something. Somewhere in there, either the big book or the 12 and 12, it says, if we have set ourselves in the right spirit, no matter how the amends goes, we'll be okay. And I've experienced that to be true. You know, I've had everything from loving arms around me, and they've accepted my amends, to utter disdain for my presence, and they didn't hear a word I had to say. And no matter which it was, I've walked away sober, and I think that's the bottom line. I walked away sober, and I felt like I could lift my head just a tad bit higher. Because see, when I came in this program, I couldn't look at you people. I just couldn't look at you. I was too full of shame and guilt and remorse. And it's so beautiful today to look out and see the smiling faces in your eyes, or as far as I can see anyway. And for some reason or other, today I have 20/20. Because I can see way to the back of the room, and I just can't do that usually. I just can't. But today I can. You know, I want to... The amends step, that Al-Anon that I told you about, She's always just dropping off little things or leaving little things around for me to see. And a few weeks ago, she left a message on my, she's a computer geek too. And she got this off the computer and she left it for me to see. So I want to take you for a moment with me, if I can, into this visualization. Because it has a lot to do with the fifth step, or the ninth step. I keep going five and nine. It has a lot to do with the ninth step. So if you'll just indulge me for a second. It says, when the house lights dimmed and the concert was about to begin, the mother returned to her seat and discovered that her child was missing. Suddenly the curtains parted and spotlights focused on a very impressive Steinway piano in the middle of the stage. In horror, the mother saw her little boy sitting at the keyboard, innocently picking away at Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And at that moment, the great piano master made his entrance, quickly moved to the piano, and whispered in the little boy's ear, "Don't quit. Keep playing." Then, leaning over, Petawaski reached down with his left hand and he began filling in the bass parts. And soon his right arm reached around to the other side of the child and he added the obbligato. And together the old master and the young novice transformed what could have been a frightening situation into a wonderful creative experience. Now the audience was so mesmerized that they couldn't recall what else the great master had played, only Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Perhaps that's the way it is with God. What we can accomplish on our own is hardly noteworthy. You know, somewhere in Scripture I remember the Apostle Paul saying, "Of myself I'm nothing." Then I open up my big book and it says, God is either everything or God is nothing. We try our best. We try our very best, and the results aren't always gracefully flowing music. However, with the hand of the master, the life's work can truly be beautiful. You know, and that's what I want to share with you. The next time that you set out to accomplish great feats, big or small, listen carefully. You may hear the voice of the master whispering in your ear, "Don't quit. Keep playing." You know, may you feel his arms around you and know that his hands are there helping you turn all of your efforts into true masterpieces. Remember, God doesn't seem to call the equipped. Rather, he equips the called. Life is more accurately measured by the lives that you touch than by the things that you acquire. So that's what I want to share with you. Reach out and touch someone. Make the amends, the tough ones. Make the difficult ones. Summon all the courage that you have. On page 85 and 86 in the 12 and 12, it says, "Head straight for the concerned and lay our cards on the table, and the rewards will be beyond your wildest dreams." The freedom that you will feel. The fact that you can be one among many. You know, I am part of a family today. I was part of a workforce for a long time. They retired me. That's why I'm here. See, before I always had the time and not the money, or the money and not the time. Now I have the time. And the money I don't worry about. Because I'm just where I'm supposed to be when I'm supposed to be there. That's kind of the way this ninth step is too. You see, I didn't have the privilege of trying to make that amends to any of my family, my biological family, because it says wherever possible. And with them it was not possible. They all died. My mother and father, they're all gone. They died rather shortly after I came to the program. But I found with those amends, and I have to share this with you, it doesn't matter if they're dead or alive, because I've made those amends to God on my knees. I took them straight to the Master, because I think that's where they go anyway. And when I got up from my knees, I felt, you know, like I belonged. And that's such a bonus in this program, the belonging. And I got to tell you something. You know, this isn't even going the way I wrote it, planned it, or shared it yesterday. So I guess I'm just sharing what I'm supposed to share. I am truly overwhelmed. At this convention has blown me away. Every speaker I've heard thus far has brought tears to my eyes. I don't think I'll ever miss another conference, God willing. I don't think I'll ever miss another one. I'll take the time and I'll find the money. Because this, you know, the AA is my life. It is my life. It's not only a way of life, but it is my life. And I don't think I'd want it any other way. You know, it is a spiritual program. And as I'm standing here, I'm thinking, why would I want to live without it? Yet I did for so long. But I don't want to today. And today is what counts in my life. And today I haven't had a drink. I really want to thank each and every one of you. I don't have... there is one more thing I want to share. That Al-Anon that I told you about. The day I left for this convention, Thursday, on a bus with 57 other people, by the way, which some of them are here. And I hope you don't misunderstand this, because there's no ego in this at all. See, this woman I hurt deeply, and that's why I keep mentioning her. I hurt her deeply. Never did I think that that relationship would be mended. Today she's my best friend. And as I was getting ready for this conference, and I had to get up, I was picked up at 6 o'clock in the morning, so... It was a quiet, nice, quiet time. And I went to set out my things for breakfast, and there was a piece of paper on the bar in my kitchen. And it says this, and I'm going to share it with you. It says, it is time to clean house and surrender all those destructive thoughts in your head. No more will you remind yourself of painful, uncomfortable times. Let go means let go. Make room in your life for happiness, success, healing, and fulfilling relationships. Keep investing in yourself. Before you know it, you'll start feeling entitled to good relationships and success. And you really should, because you are number one. And that's what I want to say to each and every one of you. Since it was given to me, I want to do what I've been taught to do ever since day one in this program, is just pass it on. So I want to thank you. That's all.
Thank you, Mary. Through step 9. Making amends, and especially the tough amends, is when I found that there was power greater than myself working in my life. I really wanted what this fellowship had to offer. Our final speaker this morning is Rosemary from New York. Rosemary.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Rosemary, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm a member of the Penfield Friday Night Group, which Penfield is a suburb of Rochester, New York, and that's where I'm from. Thank you. My sobriety date is November 7th, 1980. A very good date for me, certainly. I just want to say that with our two speakers before me, I think I better sit down. I mean, really, they were powerful. They were very good, and thank you very much for those messages. When I was telling Bill when this all started, I thought I was going to be chairing the meeting, and I was actually more comfortable with that because I really think chair people, well, you just introduce people and you don't really have to do very much. I'm sorry, Bill. But it is a more comfortable spot to be in rather than to be up here and having to share. Although, with the ninth step, hi, Steve. With the ninth step, I was really happy it was that that particular topic. When I first came to AA, it took me a while to get sober. I kept coming, which is a miracle in itself. But it took me a while before I could actually put the drink down. And in fact, I loved AA meetings. I just loved them when they talked about the drinking, their drinking history and their drinking problem and all of those things, because that's exactly where I was. I was still drinking, and I understood, I related, I identified, and then they would get to recovery. And it was, I cannot do that. And as circumstances happened, I had a couple of very good people in my life, a good psychiatrist who somebody from AA must have approached at one time because he kept telling me to go to AA. I said, no, they don't drink there. And then, but eventually through his urging and his calling, I got into my first AA meeting. So somebody approached him. Thank goodness for that for me. Anyhow, as a circumstances happened, I wound up in a treatment center in Minnesota. And it was a very strange treatment center. 6 days later, I'm taken off out of there. I mean, this place, they were going to make me go over the edge. I knew that's what they were trying to do. So I packed my bags, and they said, honey, you're on your own. I packed my bags, I got myself to the airport, and I'm coming home to Rochester. 6 days, I was terrified out of my mind. I had just come out of a psychiatric ward at Strong Memorial Hospital in Rochester from an attempted suicide, and I was really afraid. I'm sitting on this plane, and it's American Airlines plane. I was on the wing. Guess what's outside that wing? AA. I had been going to AA for 8 months. In front of me, on the back of the seat, they had these things hanging over. AA. Our placemat. AA. The cup. AA. And you know, somehow, it kind of registered. I got off the plane, I was met by an AA person, and I was taken to, guess what, an AA meeting. And, you know, from that point on, I know that that was my turning point when I was on that plane coming home, because everything that I had tried at that point had failed me. I had tried religion, I had tried to go back to the religion of my youth, and I was still drinking. I had tried psychiatry. Even though he got me into an AA meeting, he didn't cure me. You know, I still drank. And I went to AA. And AA didn't stop me from drinking. So I was really terrified. So when I got off that plane, I think I was ready. And I believe that that was the 2x4 that I needed to hit me in the back of the head and wake me up. So I was very anxious, I think, from that point on to continue through all of the steps, as I had been hearing in AA meetings. But the problem was, in my background, my family background, no one in my family ever said, I'm sorry for anything. I never heard it. I never said it, and I never heard it. It just wasn't done. Actually, what we did in our family was we just pretended it didn't happen and maybe it would go away, you know, that kind of thing. But in AA, people were talking about, you have to make direct amends. Not, I'm sorry for what I did type stuff. Direct amends. And I'll tell you, I hemmed and hawed on that. You know, I was making my way through the steps, and I stopped dead at the eighth step. And I would go to a meeting, and I would ask, I'd raise my hand for a topic. I'm on the eighth step. How do you do the eighth step? And I would hear feedback, and a lot of it said, "Well, you put yourself at the top of the list." And I thought, I don't think that's quite right. I knew that wasn't right. I heard a lot of things. But I'd still keep going to meetings, and I would ask, how do you make the eighth step? What do you do? I never asked my sponsor. Finally, I sought my sponsor out at her home group, which is a good place to find someone when you're looking for them, is at your home group. And after the meeting, I said, Anne, I said, I'm having a terrible time with this eighth step. I just don't understand how to do it. And she looked at me and she said, honey, you get off your ass and you make that list. This isn't practice. And I said, you know, I knew at that point, everything in my life I had started to do and never finished anything. It was like, it's going to happen next week. Life is going to start when we move to California. Life is going to be better when I get this job. And I never, ever really completed anything, finished anything. I never did. And when Ann told me that, I went home that night, and guess what I did? I made my list. And I realized in hindsight that the reason I was afraid of the eighth step was not the eighth step at all. That was just making the list. It was the ninth step. The ninth step, believe me, if I thought I could stay sober, that would be a step I never would have done. It just wasn't in my makeup to do that. So I made my list, and of course my family was at the top of the list. My parents were really at the top of the list. I remember hearing a talk, and I think it might have been an in-person talk from Father Martin one time. He came to Rochester, and he talked about the amend step. And what he said was, we make the amends to people, we don't hold this carrot out to people that you'll feel better after you do this. You'll feel better. He says, that is the wrong approach. He says, we make the amends because they need to be made, period. And that's what I had to do. I had to bite the bullet and just go do it. So I went to my parents' house. I told them, you know, I need to talk to both of you together. It's something I have to do for AA, you know, like I'm doing AA a big favor here. So they were home. We sat down at the kitchen table, and I really believe that my parents, they were good people. God, they were good people. I believe that they were going to say, oh, that's okay, dear. You don't have to do that. We're so happy for you now. And they didn't do that at all. They sat there, and I needed to go through every single thing that I had hurt them about. And let me tell you, it wasn't just through drinking. It was well prior to drinking. It was what my personality was about. And I sat down there, and they just shook their heads. That's right. That's right. You did that. That's right. And let me tell you, I really, it was hard. But I really felt, too, at that time that I needed to do that. They needed to hear that from me. I needed to own up to my mistakes, and they allowed me to do it. I had mostly my family. I also had, my husband had just passed away. It was actually a year and a half prior to about that time when I was making amends. And I didn't know, and I had to ask my sponsor again. I didn't know how to do this. And you can do it, make amends to someone who has passed away. And I had plenty to make up to my husband. I had a whole lot of things I had to own up to. And I was told to write it down. And I did that. I wrote down everything that I was so sorry for that I had done to hurt him. And we had been married for 14 and a half years, and he was my drinking buddy. And let me tell you, there was a lot of stuff there. And I did that, and I read it to him, and I burned it. And that's what I was told to do, burn the paper after you do that. And that is how I was taught to make amends to somebody who has passed away. I had other amends on my list, family amends. I had a very big one in my brother. I have an older brother who I had fought with most of my life. I was the baby of the family. He was the, he was the older brother. And we absolutely never got along. And for a long time, for about a seven-year period, we never even spoke. And it was over one incident. He slighted me one time. And for that, I hold grudges a long time. And my brother was not living in Rochester at the time, and I really, I couldn't even imagine saying anything to my brother about, I'm sorry, I did this to hurt. I just couldn't imagine it. And I remember talking to some good friends in AA about this amends to my brother, and I kept talking about it, and he said, if you want to make the amends, we'll hop in the car tomorrow and we'll go down and visit him and you can make your amends. And that night I went home and I wrote a letter. Now I am going to tell you right now, when Bill Wilson was asked about making amends via the mail, he said, did you hurt them via the mail? Well, I didn't know that then. I did write the letter. I was such a coward. I wrote the letter, but I had a hard time putting it in the mailbox because once I let it go, kid, that was it. And I got a letter back from him. And that's what blew me away with that amends, because my brother wrote back and he said, shoot. I was just telling Mary, I absolutely never cry. But he wrote me back and he said, that's okay, Rosemary. He says, don't you know I'm your brother and I love you. Thank you. And, my brother and I have had our ups and downs over even after that, we've still had ups and downs, but I'll never forget that, that caring and that real love that came from him. I had other amends, and it wasn't just to people. And this is what my sponsor told me. If you have taken money, if you have cheated people, if you have done things like that, guess what, honey? You owe them that. You have to pay it back. And so I had to wait until I got monies collected enough where I could do these things. And then I thought, okay, I've got some money here now. And I really hated letting go of it, but I had to. But I didn't know how to do it. One was to a company that my husband had worked for, and one was to a store that I needed to send money to. And I went to my sponsor and I said, what do I do? I can't just mail them money. I just can't do that. And she said, I don't know. She says, but let me go ask her sponsor. So, because apparently she didn't have an amends like that to make. She was lucky. Anyhow, she came back to me and she said, what you can do, I didn't know how to mail it. I really didn't. I didn't want to put cash through the mail, and I didn't know anything about money orders at that time, but that's what I did. I got a postal money order, and I wrote out into the, when I sent this thing, I wrote out into the letter that went to what it was all about, that this was something I needed to do as part of my recovery, that I needed to, if I was going to recover, but I needed to give this money back to them because I took it from them. You know, it was kind of like that Father Martin thing. You know, you need to make the amends because you need to do that. And so I did that. I sent all that money off, and to tell you the truth, I really did have a weight off me because those are the things that laid on my mind and kept me feeling guilty, kept me feeling sick. And I needed to do all of those things and get through that process. Now, I'd like to tell you today that I can say I'm sorry very easily. That's really not the truth. And I have a hard time saying I'm sorry. And there was a woman here at the convention at registration. My husband was next to me, and we were at the next person's booth. And he was trying to get me to do something. I wasn't going to do it. And he said, "See, I was right." He said, "See, I was right." And he was over there. And she said to me, "That's okay. You don't have to say you're sorry." She says, "What I say is, you're right. You're right. I never say I'm wrong." So I don't know if I'm going to take that or not, but I know that's the easier, softer way out of it, and it's not the courageous way, but it is a way. I want to thank everybody for being here today. I want to thank our two speakers ahead of us and Bill who agreed to do this chair job and everybody who is sitting here and Doug R. who invited me to participate in this panel. And I want to thank you for making this convention a beautiful success for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Rosemary. Folks, will you join me in thanking our speakers one more time? We'll go ahead and close with the Serenity Prayer.